For all Mark Brown knew, it could have been a faculty member who was monkeying around with the system. He wouldn't have been surprised if it turned out to be a student looking for a way to make trouble. 4 years earlier, in 1978, two USC students, unhappy with their grades and financial aid, had made news when they were arrested for trying to tap into the university's computer to improve their standing. Those two failed, but years later, in 1985, a year-long investigation would uncover a ring of some 30 USC students in league with someone in the school's records and registration office who routinely changed grades and created fraudulent degrees. They charged handsomely for the service, selling doctoral degrees for as much as $25,000. Brown, a young assistant in the computer lab, hadn't encountered any malicious computer attacks. In 1982, USC's attitude toward computing was typical of most universities. It wanted to keep its computers open and accessible to its users. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, security had yet to become a serious issue on college campuses. Setting up a reliable password system was just about the only security barrier at places like USC. Because so many of Digital's customers had told the company that they were more interested in convenience than security, the operating system software was shipped, with many of the built-in security features disabled. While customers could, by reading the instruction manuals, activate those security features, most customers chose not to, since increased security meant increased inconvenience. In 1982, computers and computer terminals were proliferating on college campuses so quickly that it was almost impossible for computer managers with their limited resources to pay much attention to security. Besides, placing undue restrictions on computer usage would have been like sectioning off the university library for selective access. Librarians weren't there to keep people from the books, but to lead them as easily as possible to the books they were seeking. So it was with computers as well. Still, a modest hierarchy had to be imposed on the USC computer systems. The people who watched over the system needed a master key to everyone's account, just in case they needed to retrieve a lost file or fix a student's account. Like any other computing center, USC had system managers with full access to everyone's account. And Mark Brown was one of them. Part of his job was to monitor the system's activity, to make sure that the machines were running correctly, and to provide assistance where needed. One day, he noticed that some strange things were happening. Someone was logging in to privileged accounts normally used only by system managers. So, taking the role of detective, he started trying to track the trespasser down. His first step was to place some secret traps in the operating system to catch anomalous behavior. Next, he wrote a program that watched for unusual activity on the accounts the trespasser used most frequently. Finally, he began printing out the records of the break-in attempts. After a few days, it was clear that the USC interloper was exploiting a loophole in the campus computer's operating systems to get access to the most privileged accounts on the system, and then create his own account names and passwords. Alternatively, he used the accounts of others to break into privileged accounts. The printouts showed that he was coming in over off-campus phone lines. Brown's first move was to call the phone company and have the line traced back. To do that, he learned he would need to notify the police and obtain a court order, so he decided to take it on himself. Rather than shut the intruder out of the system entirely and give up the chance to track him down, Brown limited his access and minimized the amount of damage he could do. Judging from the intruder's actions, his motive seemed relatively benign. That is, until the day one of the log scripts showed him downloading university accounting files. These are files that keep records of the establishment and deletion of accounts, and they often include password entries. Not only did the intruder have the accounting files, he also had managed to use a privileged account to steal personal mail files from systems people like Brown, presumably in order to glean further information about the computer system. That was stepping over the line. Gentlemen do not read other people's mail. Brown began taking countermeasures. Brown considered himself a hacker in the hallowed traditional sense of the word. To him, hacking was the honorable pursuit of perfection in computer programming. It did not mean breaking into someone else's system. Brown decided it would take someone who thought like an intruder to catch one. He called for help from a couple of his fellow programmers, including John Solomon, a former phone freak, and started the chase. After a week of intensive monitoring, they realized that on certain days, the phantom visitor was entering the school's computers at much higher speeds than usual. He could do that, they reasoned, only from a specific terminal room, where the only high-speed links could be found. Brown had been around the computer community long enough to see a lot of cockiness, but this was incredible. They knew that the next time the high-speed connection came, it would take a bit of maneuvering to isolate where the intruder was in the computer lab, but it could be done. To make things more efficient, they decided to risk scaring him off with their obvious tampering. They limited his access to one machine. One night, when Brown went out to dinner, he left Solomon to watch for the trespasser. No sooner had he left than the intruder was online, and his connection was coming from inside the campus. It took Solomon only a few minutes to trace the terminal. It was spooky. The interloper was at work in the very lab where Solomon was sitting. Solomon walked across the room and stood a few feet behind an overweight young man with a familiar face who was sifting through a stack of papers he seemed to be using as a reference. He was oblivious to anything else in the room. Solomon stepped a couple of feet closer to look over the intruder's shoulder. The papers were copies of the stolen accounting files. Next to the intruder sat another man who seemed much younger than the first. They appeared to be together. Suddenly, Solomon placed the familiar face. He had met the chunky hacker weeks earlier at a Dacos conference. The hacker had struck Solomon as pretty cocky, boasting about his exploits. Solomon knew that his name was Mitnick, and that he had been arrested in the past for breaking into computers. Neither Mitnick nor his friend was enrolled at USC. Hurriedly, Solomon stepped away and called the campus police. In the few minutes it took for the police to arrive, Solomon watched as the pair kept typing, logging in and trying out different passwords. Solomon was beginning to get the feeling that he could have watched them for an hour without their noticing him, so engrossed were they in the task at hand. When the two officers appeared in the doorway, Brown's assistant pointed to the older of the two strangers, and they flanked his chair. When the plump young man looked up, his face expressed none of the guilt or remorse that Solomon expected to see. Here was a known computer criminal who wasn't merely breaking into the computers of a private university with which he had no legitimate connection. He strolled onto campus to do it. Solomon expected to see some sign of self-rebuke, at least some surprise that he had been caught in the act. Instead, when the police questioned him, Mitnick took offense. "I'm not doing anything wrong," he said. The papers he was working with, he claimed, belonged to him. His friend sat nearby, discernibly more nervous. When the officers asked Mitnick to step outside, he picked up his thick stack of computer printouts, tucked the sheaf under his arm, and obliged. The officers took both of them to the campus police station. At the security office, the police took their names, Kevin David Mitnick and Leonard Mitchell DeSico. When Brown and Solomon questioned Mitnick, his attitude was supercilious, as if under other circumstances he wouldn't deign to answer. He taunted Brown for what he claimed were unsophisticated sleuthing tactics. They never would have caught him, he claimed, if he hadn't made himself such an easy target by coming onto campus. In a record search, the campus police discovered that Mitnick was on juvenile probation for breaking into other computers, and that DeSico, barely 17, had been caught 6 months earlier doing the same thing at Cal State Northridge. They handcuffed Mitnick and DeSico to a bench and called the L.A. police to come fetch them. In spite of Kevin's cool reaction to Brown, his fear of getting caught was so profound that it gave him heart palpitations so severe that he would soon have to depend on heart medication usually taken by people 3 times his age. Nonetheless, he seemed to realize the inevitability of arrest. He had once told Lenny that he knew he would get caught again after the Cosmos stunt. He had been lucky that time, getting probation instead of jail. Nevertheless, his compulsive side had won out over his fear of the consequences, and now here he sat, handcuffed to a bench. It was a conflict that would play itself out for years to come as Kevin's obsession intensified, and at his side, not so much because he sought it, but rather because he couldn't avoid it, would be Lenny, a faithful but not always willing companion. The bench was in a narrow hall next to the door, 20 feet away from a security officer working at a desk. By now, Lenny was familiar with the deep fear that came with getting busted, but as a juvenile, he knew he was better off than Kevin. When he had been caught at Cal State Northridge, he had been detained and released after a few hours. His parents hadn't even punished him. Kevin, on the other hand, was now 19 and could get this put on his adult record. Kenny prodded Kevin. "Hey, Kev," he said, reaching into his back pocket for his wallet. He grinned as he produced a handcuff key. Lenny unlocked his own handcuffs, then Kevin's. The two sat speechless for a moment. Lenny broke the silence. "You go ahead. You've got a lot more to risk. Take off." Both looked over at the officer, who appeared to be paying no attention to his wards. The door next to the bench was unlocked. Kevin's car was in a parking lot just a few yards away. Lenny's mind was perhaps too full of comic strips and spy thrillers. He had a madcap side to him that tended to surface just as a situation was spinning out of control. His escape plan for Kevin came straight from fiction. Lenny's plan would have brought Kevin closer to being a true criminal than Kevin could have imagined for himself. Kevin rejected Lenny's plan, not out of reason, but out of fear. He was too scared to try to flee by himself. Kevin would try it only if Lenny came to. Lenny sighed and snapped his own cuffs back into place. He dropped the key onto the floor and pushed it under the bench with his foot. When Kevin tried to lock his own cuffs again, he couldn't. The noise Kevin was making in his efforts to engage the hardware caught the attention of their guard. He got up from his seat and checked Lenny's cuffs, then turned to Kevin. As he pulled on Kevin's arm, it swung free. "So we've got a Houdini over here," the officer remarked. He searched both of them thoroughly and shackled Kevin back to the bench. "Do this again and I'm going to handcuff you to the toilet," he warned. When Solomon and Brown returned to the computer room to examine the terminals where Mitnick and DeSico had been seated, they saw that Mitnick's terminal had just logged out of a computer called Alexwash. Solomon recognized it as a Defense Department computer, but he couldn't tell what Mitnick had been doing with the account. Brown looked over the stack of printouts that had been confiscated from Mitnick, and he saw that it had a list of passwords to all the local accounts that had been created in the past 2 months. The stack also contained account names and passwords of companies Brown knew to be affiliated with the Defense Department, and what appeared to be secret information about genetic research by a company called IntelliGenetics. All of the computers were connected to the ARPANET, the computer network funded by the military that connected non-classified military installations, military contractors, universities, and research centers around the world. At first, Lenny thought he was going to get out of this one without a scratch. For some reason, USC decided to drop the charges, and as punishment at home, his parents grounded him for a week. Then, in a puzzling reversal, 6 months later, USC refiled the charges, and Lenny was summoned to appear in court. He pled guilty to a felony as a juvenile and got a year's probation. Dominic Domino, the detective in charge of the Los Angeles Police Department's Young Computer Crime Unit, wanted to see Kevin somehow rehabilitated. In his police report, Domino wrote a brief summary of the case, ending it with an ominous observation. "This defendant is expert at computers and apparently enjoys the challenge of breaking computer codes. He will undoubtedly continue to be a police problem in this area unless maturity rechannels his energy and ambition." So Kevin went to jail. 6 months at the California Youth Authority's Carl Holston Training School, a juvenile prison in Stockton, California, with about 450 inmates. Carl Holton was one of the more secure prisons in the state. Violence-prone teenagers who were difficult to control were sent there for crimes ranging from armed robbery to murder. Kevin was doubtless the only inmate convicted of breaking into computer systems. Living conditions at Holton were harsh. The prison was overcrowded, there was minimal personal privacy, and there was a great deal of violence. But Kevin tried to make productive use of his time there. He became something of a jailhouse lawyer, and he developed a computer program for tracking fellow wards of the court. He also worked with the Los Angeles police to put together an instructional videotape on computer security. He was released in late 1983.